Blog Talk Radio.
How long you've been living in my mind? How long you've been living in my mind?
Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth in Agony, out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest writer Greg Oliar. How are you, Greg?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. It's a pleasure. Greg Oliar is the founding editor of the Weeklings and the LA Times, best-selling author of novels Totally Killer and Father Mucker. I love that title, Greg. I was hoping you could open today's show by talking about your literary website, The Weeklings. How did it start? What's your mission? Who are some of your writers?
Yeah, I can. I'm happy to do that. First, I want to say thanks again for having me on. It's an honor and privilege to be here. And I just want to throw a quick shout out to, I'm sure everybody listening to this knows you and your work well, but I'll say to anyone who hasn't had the pleasure of seeing Rich perform live, please go do so, because he's really fantastic.
And I have to give you a thanks, too, because, man, you know, you truly rallied when I came to New York a few years ago to perform, man. I'll never forget that. You totally rallied, so thank you for that. For coming out.
Yeah, well worth my time. It was great. It was a great show. So to get back to the question at hand, The Weeklings is a site that we founded about a year and a half ago, and the sort of idea behind it, I came up with this idea really more 2 or 3 years ago, back when I was writing for, as you were and are, for The Nervous Breakdown. And, what I wanted to do, I thought it would be nice if we had a site that, rather than just try to bombard the internet with pieces, like the Huffington Post is this, for example, is this sort of machine of content that just gets cranked out. I mean, I don't know how many they have a day, but it's a huge number. And even most of the other sites have kind of a, you know, they at the minimum they'll throw up 5 posts a day or something like that. And I thought it would be good if we had something that wasn't like that, where we just limited ourselves to one post a day, and that's it. So that would be our sort of formula, you know, we one post a day every single day, and that's what we would do. So each post would be given the requisite 24 hours in the spotlight, and then we would move on to something else. And Sean Baudouin, one of my co-editors at Weakling, sort of equates us to the slow food movement of the internet, and I think that's a good a good analogy. So the original concept was that there would be 7 writers, and each of the writers would take one day of the week, and we would all write every week on the same day. So my day is Tuesday, and Sean's was Wednesday, and Jennifer Cabot, another of my founding editors, was Thursday, and so on. And that went on for some time. I personally did write every day, every week, I mean, for a year. But it gets kind of hard to do that after a while. You know, it's kind of a marathon and stuff like that. But that's what the name means. We're Weeklings because we write every week. And it's Weeklings, W-E-E-K. We sort of inverted the spelling as John Lennon did for Beatles, you know. The opposite way. So, and one of the reasons that I wanted to do it, first was this sort of system that I'd come up with of, you know, one post a day. And the second reason is I really wanted it to delve into different issues that were being handled that I was used to writing about. It was the election year that we started this, and I really wanted the site to include politics in a way that I could talk about what was on my mind and other people could, and we could delve into some issues that we didn't see written about elsewhere. Not that that's all that we do. We do a lot of different kinds of stuff. But that's how it started. That was the seeds of it. And now we've been up for, like I said, it'll be 18 months. I think it's this month or next month. It'll be 18 months up, and we went from being a pretty small affair to, you know, now we have pretty legitimate traffic. We have a syndication arrangement with Salon and with Good Men Project, and they often reprint some of our essays. We've been mentioned on the Andrew Sullivan's The Dish occasionally. We were on Minnesota Public Radio. They kind of cite our work, and I'm personally very gratified that we were once mentioned at the New Yorker. So that's
nice.
That's, yeah, you know, that to me, that's like the sign of legitimacy.
What's that?
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the things I love about the site is that it's such a broad variety of writing. I mean, you've got, you know, as you mentioned before, politics. There are, you know, more literary pieces, but also, you know, pop culture, music. In fact, one of your writers, who's absolutely one of my favorite writers, Joe Daly. I love the music writing that he does for your site.
Yeah, he's great, and you know, that's something that came later. We were always kind of mixing it up, you know, we brought Sean and I sort of kicked off the music page, and then Joe came in and took it over. And he's, you know, he's fantastic. He brings in great people and interviews great people. And J.M. Blaine is on there. He's written some great stuff, some really
absolutely interesting
interviews. You know, we've had Moby on there. We've had Al Jorgensen from Ministry, and my personal favorite, Weird Al. You know, so
nice.
I can die a happy man now because Al was at my site.
Nice.
Yeah, that's been going great. We're also actually soon, I guess next Saturday, we're like in a couple of days, actually, we're kicking off Saturday. Music is going to move to Monday, and now Saturday is going to be like about sex and intimacy and vice and that sort of thing. And Antonia Crean is going to edit.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, she's the name of the feature on Saturday is Welcome Kink, and she's going to be the editor of that. And we already have four or five pieces already in the queue, ready to roll, and we're really excited about that too.
Nice.
So now
she's
we
here
have
in LA, actually.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit more of an LA. Sean lives in Seattle, but me and Jen and Janet Steen, another of the, there's four of us who are sort of the collectivist editors of the site. We all live in, you know, the three of us live in upstate New York in the same little relative area.
Right.
You know, Woodstock extended, I guess you could say. So we're getting more of a broader reach, which is nice.
Nice. You know, speaking of music, you know, we were talking about music before. One of your pieces that I absolutely love, it was a piece you wrote about Mark Sandman from Morphine. And
yeah.
It just struck me, you wrote about music and you wrote about Mark so fluidly. Are you a musician yourself?
I have some. I would not use that word in any meaningful way.
Right.
I would hesitate to qualify myself as that, but I do have some background in that area. I mean, I play guitar a little bit, and if you don't know how to play guitar and you heard me play guitar, you would think I was good. But if you know how to play, you know that I'm just faking it. You know,
right.
You know
right.
that I'm full of it. So, but I have a good understanding of it, and you know what interests me is the music, and also how music fits into part of the larger popular culture. Which,
yeah.
You know, that's kind of what that piece was about. I mean, I'm not a big concert goer, and I never have been. I haven't really, you know, I don't go to a lot of shows, but I had the luck, I guess, to see them play in the 90s, in the mid 90s, and they were just so fantastic. He's like you know, you have some similarity with him because he's sort of a spoken word guy. Masquerading
yeah.
in this band, you know, and he's really just that's what he is, and that's what he did, and he was so good at it. And he was so funny live. And I remember thinking at the time, I can't even listen to the studio albums because they're terrible compared to how they are live. And now, of course, you listen to studio albums and they're fantastic. So,
right.
That's how good they were that I thought that for a long period of time. So,
yeah. You mentioned pop culture before, you know, and you talk about pop culture a lot in some of your different writing on the Weaklings and such. You know, case in point, after the whole, you know, Miley Cyrus VMA twerking incident, I noticed that you posted a video on your Facebook page of Miley performing some songs with her band in her backyard, and, you know, it was all very organic, and it was actually, you know, quite a she was, you know, quite lovely in spirit and voice, and definitely a different image than what had been conveyed at the awards ceremony. And, you know, you commended her for that in the sort of post that you had for the video. What are your thoughts today about today's pop culture, you know, sort of American Idol, boy bands, Kardashians, Justin Bieber, Lindsay Lohan, and a lot? You know, there's obviously some talent to be found here and there, but there's also what might be, you know, referred to as bad behavior, serious lack of forethought, talent. Do you feel that there are some bright spots in today's pop culture?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I should add that I live with one of the great Hannah Montana / Miley Cyrus fans in the person of my 7-year-old daughter. So that's why I knew about those things on her site. And, you know, Miley is she's very talented. I mean, that's why she was on the show. That's, you know, she's good. She's a good singer. She's a charismatic personality. She's great on her show. You know, not that the show is, you know, it's not Breaking Bad or something, but, you know, she's got it, whatever it is. And I think it's interesting now because she's trying to figure it out, and I think it'll be interesting to see what she winds up doing. I think right now she's sort of like a shapeshifter, and she's trying on these different personae to see what sticks. But I think with her, ultimately, the template that she's going to look at is Timberlake, because I think that she has the potential to go from being kind of a, you know, somebody who is inspired all these very young people into being something that in her adult life will be good. She's very funny. She's I don't know if you ever saw her on SNL. They do this sketch on SNL called the Miley Cyrus Show where they totally make fun of her, and she was on as the guest and she played Justin Bieber on the show. And
nice.
Really, really funny. So, you know, she's not, we haven't heard the last of her.
For
pop culture in general, I think pop music now is fantastic. I think it's better than it's been in a long time. I think that after the 80s kind of washed away, there was a long period of time where pop music, meaning stuff you'd listen to like on the popular radio stations or stuff that, you know, the kids would listen to, was terrible. I mean, particularly in the 90s, you know, it wasn't that great.
Right.
I don't count like Pearl Jam and Nirvana as being pop music. I mean, it's,
no,
but now you've got a lot of really, really good people. I mean, Taylor Swift, lover or hater, she's been around for a long time, and she, you know, that song that it's good. It's the you know, we will never ever getting back together. I think Kesha is really good. I think Amy Winehouse is gone now, but she was fantastic. And who am I forgetting? There's just a lot of people. I mean, I tend to like the music that my daughter listens to. Even that one One Direction song is really solid. It's not a bad song by any means. So,
you know,
I think
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, speaking of Taylor Swift, there's this great piece that you have on the Weaklings about why Taylor Swift should date a writer, and I was hoping you could share some of those with the audience.
Oh yeah, well, you know, I can't remember off the top of my head, but you know, there's this of Us Weekly, which I don't read it as obsessively as I once did. You know, we see these young women of you know, who are celebrities and talented ones in her case, go out with these people that are, you know, you just know that it's not going to work out. And I basically argue that, you know, a writer's the way to go, because we'd be, you know, it's not like we're going to be all, oh no, I need to be more famous than you. We'll just be totally happy with it. We'll go on tour, you know, we'll be solid. You can bring us to parties. We'll help you with your lyrics and make you sound smarter, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I don't know if she's going to take my advice. I mean, it's also funny, these magazines like, oh, this person needs to settle down, and this person is, you know, and these are people that are like in their early 20s. I mean, who the heck said, I didn't know what I was doing when I was that age. And
I know exactly right.
They should do otherwise is madness.
Yeah.
So,
you know, in the manifesto for the Weaklings, I love how you spoke about where you compared the motion picture industry to the internet, how one is free, one is not. And one of your missions for the Weekly was to, you know, to be able to offer your writers, you know, some sort of compensation for their work, for their time. I was wondering if you could talk about that, because I really thought that that was a wonderful piece and a really great sentiment.
Thank you. We were thinking about it, and we always want to pay the writers. You know, we're writers. We live in this culture where writers write stuff for online publications and don't even expect to get paid for it. We get paid in traffic and exposure, whatever that is. I don't think it's something that you can take to the bank and trade for food, but and we're supposed to be happy with that, and often we are. You know, it's great to bang out a little essay and see it go up somewhere and have people read it, and it's very gratifying. But at the end of the day, there needs to be some sort of model where writers get paid for what they're doing, because the blog, you know, we add a lot of content to readers. So, I think that blog people who are good contribute a valuable service, and it's entertainment, it's thoughtfulness, and it's artistry at its best. And, you know, it should be not taken for granted in the way that it is. And I compared it to the motion picture industry, because at that time there were these people that just, it was a brand new thing. Nobody had ever, you know, a screen actor was something completely new that had never existed in the history of the world, just like an online writer is a new thing. Very new. But the difference is that, you know, the movies, it cost 7 cents to go to the movies, but people went all the time, and you had all of that money coming in, and eventually it found its way to the actors and to the directors, and to all those people eventually unionized, and, you know, to this day, they make decent money. The only ones that don't make decent money are the ones that didn't unionize. And we feel that we don't want to be, you know, we don't have nearly the traffic that some of these other places do. And we're never, maybe I won't want to say never, but it's unlikely we'll be able to give anybody any major money. But we decided to make the commitment that any revenue that we have left over after our base expenses, we're just going to divide up and send out to the writers, period.
Right.
You know? And I don't know how much money that's going to be. I mean, we are in the black, and we're going to continue to be so, God willing. But, you know, even if we pay somebody something that exists almost as a, sentimentally rather than real money, you know, here, okay, you're going to make $4 or something. At least that's $4 more than Huffington pays. So, at least we're trying. We're putting our money where our mouth is. And, I hope that our traffic goes up, because I would like to pay everybody more. You know, I mean, I don't make any money from the site. None of the editors do. We would also make our money from what we write and what we contribute. So, it's kind of a thing that, I think hopefully will benefit everybody in the long run. And I think if everybody adapted this model, the world would be a better place.
Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of, like you, I'm a big fan of artists, you know, writers, musicians, poets, whatever, getting paid for their work, you know, though sometimes people get a little too hung up on the idea of making money at what they do. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the perils of this kind of mentality?
Well, I mean, I know people that I won't write anything unless I get paid for it. Well, okay, but if you're, you know, it's a mercenary kind of attitude to have, and ultimately, I mean, at the end of the day, anybody that's writing online or writing fiction, God knows, is not doing it for the money. I mean, you make more money hourly going as working at Starbucks as a barista or something. Like, it's not a lucrative field. It's becoming less lucrative as the channels of financial supply kind of dry up. So.
Yeah.
You know, we're in here to find an audience, ultimately. I mean, that's what everybody wants, I think. People want people to read their stuff and hopefully, you know, like it. And, you know, I think that is really what everybody is gunning for. I mean, I can't speak for every single person, but that, I know that's what I want. I want, you know, I want to write something and have people read it. And
absolutely.
You know, if it so happens that I make money from that, that is gravy. But I don't think that you can go into it as an expectation.
Yeah.
But that said, from my standpoint as an editor and therefore a management member, it's my responsibility in that role to make sure that the revenue gets sent out. You know, like I have to, if I want it, I have to do what I say that I want other sites to do.
Right.
It's hard. It's a hard thing to grapple with in a lot of ways, because it's, you know, you're it used to be in the 1950s you could, you know, you publish two or three short stories a year and you can live on that for a year, and you know that's not the case anymore. Of course, the flip side is that there's much more stuff is published, which is good, I think, ultimately, but you know, all of the money, you know, it's not what it used to be. Let's just leave it at that.
Right. What do you think the future holds in this regard?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, people are online reading all the time. You know, they're reading news sites, they're reading Facebook things, they're reading blog posts, they're reading short stories now are making a comeback because of the digital formats, and you know, people read all the time, and ultimately, in order for there to be enough content to satisfy this need, money will have to go that way. And I think that, you know, sites like the New York Times have sort of figured this out a little bit. You know, what's really going to be interesting is what Bezos does with the Washington Post.
Right.
Which is a terrific newspaper and one of my favorite places to go, and they have great columnists and a history of breaking big stories. And here's a guy who, you know, clearly cares about making money on some level. And what is he? You know, he saw value in this paper. So what is he going to do with it? How is he going to make it profitable? I worked at Associated Press in the early days of the internet, basically, when they were trying to figure out what was going to happen with the ad revenue. And I think nobody really could figure it out. You know, somebody made a decision early on that it should be free, and that decision came back to collectively bite everybody in the ass. And I think the newspapers now are trying to grab their piece of it. And I don't know where, you know, how it's going to shake itself out. I mean, it might be, to me, it's irritating if I go online and I have to, like, sign up for something and give them my credit card, and it's just a pain. So Right. Maybe there's some sort of system where they can, you know, maybe you buy into you sign up once a year and you can go anywhere. And some company keeps track of who goes where and just allocates the resources accordingly so that, you know, as a user, you don't have to worry about it so much. You know, you don't have to think about it. Like I say, I pay $20 a month to be able to go on any site if it got that way. You know, I go on ESPN, I go on Washington Post, I go on The Guardian and stuff like that enough that it's worth, you know, it's worth it. So somebody will figure it out. There's smarter people than me, certainly, working to figure this out, and I think that they will. But people will continue to write, and I think that people will continue to read. I don't know what formats it will take. You know, it'll just be interesting to watch, I guess.
Yeah. So let's move from the digital age for a few moments into the world of good old-fashioned books in hand. You know, you're the author of two novels, Totally Killer and Father Mucker, Father Mucker being your most recent novel. I was hoping you could talk a little about it.
Well, I've got the two books. Totally Killer was first. That's kind of a thriller kind of thing. It's almost like a spoof of The Firm, set in 1991 Manhattan. And that came out, and I got lucky because it got translated into French. And the best thing that happened for me was with that book was getting to go to France on a book tour.
Nice.
Which was fantastic. I mean, they treated me like, you know, they know how to treat writers in France. And it was fantastic. And I sold more copies of the book in French than I did in English, which makes me one of those assholes who are more popular in France than he is in the United States.
Nice.
You know, as a writer, what else do you need in life than that?
Right.
You know, so, but, you know, that was a wonderful experience and you know, very grateful for that. And the other scuttlebutt about Totally Killer is that I sold the film rights to it, and supposedly Bret Easton Ellis is working on it, developing it into a TV show.
Yeah, I saw that. I was actually going to ask you about that.
You know, and who knows? I mean, this stuff is, you know, it's clearly the company that I sold it to is one of the producers of House of Cards. You know, and Bret Ellis has, you know, some experience along these lines, so hopefully he'll get around to it. It's up his alley, certainly. And for me, just, I mean, I've had no contact with him at all. I don't, you know, at all. It's less than zero contact, you might even say. But, you know, I love him. Yeah, thank you. And I love him. He's one of my favorite writers. And you know, certainly when I was younger and reading a lot, he was, you know, really influenced my writing a lot. And so it's thrilling that he read the book and wanted to do something with it. You know, so that whether something happens from it, who knows, you know. But, you know, and until it does, it's just kind of a story that I can tell at parties or something. And I can make it sound like a bigger deal than it is. But, you know, but it's cool. You know, I'm sort of stunned, I guess, by the whole thing.
Right. I'm curious about the French translation of Totally Killer. I mean, how did that come about? Did they reach out to you? Did your publisher reach out to them? Or
my agents have agents there that somehow found this company. It's called Edition Gallmeister. His name is Oliver Gallmeister, and he's all they publish is American novels, usually like written by men. France has this whole kind of writing style, and I guess it's almost a subgenre of, like, basically what I call guy books. And, you know, so some of the other things they do are, like, almost like these cowboy kind of things, not like Westerns, but, you know, things that are really kind of masculine, which we don't really have the equivalent of here. And so they, you know, they liked the book and because of, I guess they thought it was manly or something. And and they published it, and they're great. It's, you know, they're small, and then they're fantastic. The translation, I mean, I speak French a tiny bit, but apparently the translation is really good, and, you know, that's what I've heard, and their publicist was great. So, you know, it was and my editor is wonderful there, my French editor, Philippe. The first one night that I was there, it was a Wednesday, and we were having a party at his apartment, he and his wife's apartment, which is, like, literally right around the corner from the Moulin Rouge, this big, like, awesome apartment in Paris. And all these booksellers were there, and it was, like, Wednesday, and it started at 7. And I thought to myself, okay, I'll probably be back at the hotel maybe by 10, maybe I'm asleep at 11. I didn't leave there till like, 2 in the morning. I mean, once these guys started talking, I could barely understand. You know, it was hard to keep up with what they were saying, but it was just very thrilling to be in a place where people were passionate about books and literature and, you know, enough to hang out drinking wine and talking about it till the wee hours.
Nice.
Now, one of the interesting things about France is that it's illegal in France to sell a book for less than, I forget what the cover, what the percentage is, if it's 10 or 15% off the cover price. And therefore, Amazon in France can't do what they've done here. They can't, you know, buy vast quantities and undersell all the bookstores to the point where they go extinct. And consequently, there's a bookstore in every third corner in Paris. You know, and it's that's a case where socialism has helped, you know, save the culture and the industry, which I think is fine.
Exactly.
I think it's good. Vive la France, exactly. I say.
Exactly. You know, and totally, speaking of Totally Killer, you open up the book with Todd's Totally Killer cassette tape mix for Taylor. And
right.
I'm curious, what would be, let's say, your top five Desert Island books and records, and why?
Oh, God. I think we're going to run out of time if I even attempt to.
Give me a couple.
Well, I have a book. I think it's the Penguin edition of British Poetry. It's really thick, And I love that book. It's got like all, everything's in there, you know. So I would certainly bring that, even though it doesn't have everything that's British that I like, but it has enough that that would certainly be the number one thing that I would bring. Let's see. I would bring The Portable Curmudgeon, which is a list of quotes that's really funny. I would bring, I'm looking at my bookshelf now. Let's see here. Certainly not one of my books. I'd probably bring Ulysses. Let's see. What else would I bring? I'm forgetting.
What about music?
Music, I mean, it's hard to tell. Like your tastes sort of evolve over time. I mean,
absolutely.
I would think I'd have to bring some Beatles thing, and I'd have to bring some Elvis Costello thing, and I would definitely bring the Sufjan Stevens Illinois album. That would be number one, I think. And something classical, too. I don't know what. Something along
right.
and classical.
Right. So you went from Totally Killer,
mm-hmm.
great book, and then you wrote Father Mucker, which is, you know, I guess in some ways you could say there are some similarities, but in other ways, a very different experience. So I was wondering if you could talk about Father Mucker and how you got to that book from Totally Killer.
Yeah, well, I had written, I wrote another book that I wrote before Totally Killer, and I rewrote it and I submitted it and it got turned down. And it was a book that I had been working on for years in various forms, and I was sort of discouraged. And my wife said, you know, you should just write about, like, what's going on now. And at the time, I was, you know, the kids were very little, and that we were just in this bubble of parenthood. And parenting kids who are, you know, preschoolers or whatever is or younger, you know, it's a very specific animal. It's a very weird time, and I decided that I wanted to try to do that, and I wanted to capture the time. For one thing, when you're around little kids a lot, you censor yourself because you can't swear, you can't yell, you really have to watch what you say a lot, and consequently, your interior monologue becomes very, very rich and expirated, and I decided that I wanted to try to get all of that, and really it was just a vehicle for me to riff on, you know, funny things and about fatherhood and things I'd observed, and I decided to set it all in one day because I always wanted to do. I like things that are all in one day. So Father Mucker is just basically one day in the life of this stay-at-home dad living in New Paltz, which is where I live, and you know, there's a lot of similarities with my life. Certainly the kids in the book are very similar to my own kids. The characters a little bit less so. And that was it. It was just an attempt to capture and chronicle this kind of thing. It's like a time capsule in a way. I haven't read it in a while, but I think when I go back and read it, I'll remember all these things that I had forgotten. And, you know, it'll be good for me to have done it.
Right.
So, and then the title just—I forget when I was going to do a blog way back when, and I thought of that title, Father Mucker, for the blog, and I never really got rolling with it. But I don't know. I always thought it would be a good title, and I think that they bought it because of the title. The other weird thing is that I submitted it as a proposal, which you often cannot do when you're somebody with no track record, and they accepted it, to my surprise, on proposal. I think they did it because of the title, really.
Right.
But because I wrote it that way, I had to write an outline, a kind of detailed outline, and, you know, and it helped me writing the outline. I don't usually write a formal outline. I just kind of know where it's going, and that kind of made me focus, and I gave them exactly what I said I would do. And I'm
right.
happy with how it turned out. You know, I think it's – and France didn't want that book. That book got translated into German.
Well, Father Mucker already sounds sort of like a German word anyway.
Doesn't it? They did not give me the umlaut over the U, which I really want. but it's there in Germany, and, I, you know, and that kind of blows my mind a little, you know. I wrote this book in which my real daughter is she's kind of in the book in some ways. You know, somebody in I don't even know, in Hamburg is going to read about that in German. It's sort of
right.
kind of mind-blowing in a way, you know.
Have you been over to Germany yet to read?
No, I don't think that's in the cards, unfortunately.
Okay.
But I can't speak German at all, though. I can speak just enough French that I can get around a little, but German, forget it. I would be
right.
completely helpless.
Right.
So,
you know, some artists have the fear that if they get married or have a family, it'll stifle their creativity. But with you, I get a completely different impression. How have your wife and children made you a better person and a better writer?
Oh, well, I mean, they've certainly made me a better person. I mean, there's no, it just makes you less selfish and more family oriented and all of that stuff. But it, you know, people have kids. I mean, people, you live in as a writer or a novelist anyway, I'm trying to report on the world in some way. And, you know, to sort of hole up and be and somewhere and then claim to know what everybody's thinking when many, many people get married and have kids is silly. I mean, you know, having kids has totally enriched my understanding of that side of things. You know, being a father is very different from, you know, not being a dad. You just, you know, my kids are now in, what are they now? They just started school. They're in second grade and third grade. It makes me think about what I was like at that time and how things have changed and what might be important to them and what was important to me. And you kind of almost have to go through and rethink all of these things. And,
right.
You know, it just broadens my understanding of the world and myself. And it cuts into your free time, for sure. To the point where sometimes it's really discouraging, but you know, it's been great for that. I mean, I couldn't have written Fatherbucker without them. Clearly, I'm sure I would have written something else, but it wouldn't have been that level of thing. So, you know, I'm very grateful. I'm very lucky that I have a great wife and who I get along with and who I love and like and who helps me, and you know, and my kids are good. So, you know, I recommend it.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of something that you just mentioned, that issue of time, I mean, how are you able to balance the issue of time, of being a father, of being a husband, of being a novelist, and also working on The Weaklings? You know, how are you able to sort of fit all that in to your life? Do you have a strict schedule or...
No, it's, you know, it's hard. It's hard to do. And I'm working on a new book now. It took me a little while to figure out what exactly I wanted to do. I did some other smaller projects, and I've spent a lot of time on Weaklings, both writing and you know, getting other people involved and all of the ins and outs of it. So, you know, that takes up a lot of time, but you know, it's hard to know. It's hard to make the time. You know, my life isn't as free. Even when I was home with the kids and then they would go to preschool or kindergarten, then I had some hours in the day. And it's not quite like that anymore because of my other work commitments. So, you know, I'm having difficulty a little bit carving time out. But I'm hoping that now that school starts and that their lives get a little more regimented, that I'll get back on track a little bit, because the book I'm looking at writing, I already have I know exactly what it's going to do and what it's going to say, and I wrote the synopsis, and it's just a matter of writing it, of banging it out. And I don't think it's going to be very long, so, you know, if I had a month of nothing else to do, I would finish it easily, I think, but that's not going to happen, so I'll figure it out. I always figure these things out. You know, I just keep grinding away.
Yeah. You know, you've had some people say that Fathermucker, which is a work of fiction, might, you know, actually be a thinly veiled memoir. You know, in a different way, this reminds me of, you know, that whole James Frey incident where he created fictional portions of his life and sold it as a memoir. And to me, this begs the question, how strong or fluid do you think the boundaries need to be between, you know, genres like fiction, memoir writing, and the like?
Well, now you're getting, now you're delving into the David Shieldsian reality hunger stuff, which I love him, and I love reading, you know, I love walking around in his mind a little. And I don't know that there's a formal answer. I mean, any fictional thing that's worth anything is based on real stuff. I mean, it has
absolutely
to be, because
absolutely.
you're coming at it. You can't just make everything up. It's not realistic, and you want to, or I want to anyway, have things that read true. You know, so what am I going to write? I can't write like a. I'm not a spy. You know, I can't write a real novel about a spy or something like that, because I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. So I have to write to some degree from my experience. But in fiction, there's a way to take things that have happened to you and shape them and mold them in such a way that you make them more universal and more compelling, and you get to say what you want to say in a way that is more instructive to the reader. I mean, that's what I think I'm trying to do. You know, memoir is or has become anyway a much similar thing. You're trying to take something very specific that has supposedly really happened to you, and shaping it in a way that does the same thing, to maximize its instructiveness and this and that. And sometimes if I'm writing about something that's true, quote unquote, or something that is based on something that happened, it's hard because I want the details to be accurate. And often that gets in the way of the story being good.
Right.
You know, which is why if you see, oh, well, in this memoir, three different characters were combined to make one character of the friend. You know, I have no problem with that. It's irrelevant to the larger arc of a story if you had the conversation with person B instead of person A. You know, who cares? I think that... With Fry, I mean, you know, there's a certain level of expectation, I think, when you call something a memoir, that you're not going to just start making shit up or embellishing to a ridiculous degree. There's a sort of contract that you make with your reader, and you do this in fiction too. You're making the agreement with the reader that what you're reading is something specific. You know, there's another book, the guy, what's his name, Maxick, who wrote the book about the, you know, the teacher at the school in Paris, and then that was a fictional book, and a work of fiction, and it turns out that a lot of it isn't, that people at the school have complained and this and that, and you know, that's an interesting thing too. I think it's much easier to call something fiction that's true and have it be okay than the opposite. You know, I think if you can embellish a lot of things, but there's a certain level, there's a certain line in memoir that you can't cross. Not because of some artistic this or that, but because you're violating an agreement with the reader. The reader has been led to believe that this happened on some level, and if it didn't, then you're basically disrespecting the reader, and that's really, I think, the problem that people have with it. When Oprah got all pissed off, it wasn't, you know, it's because he violated an agreement that he had with her and every reader. You know, I didn't read that book. I don't care. You know, he seems like a nice guy or whatever. That's the sort of thing. And fiction writers do this too. I don't like Franzen, and one of the reasons I don't like him is because I feel like he condescends to his readers. I don't like that. I think it's, you know, I don't want to be condescended to. That's it. I don't care what he has to say. That's it. When you're writing stuff, you're developing a relationship to your reader. And it's important. It's an important relationship, because why write if you're not going to care about what the reader's going to think?
Yeah, well, speaking of that relationship, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I want to ask you just a couple more questions. Speaking of that relationship, in this day and age, what do you think are some of the best ways for a writer to develop a relationship with their audience, or once they have a relationship, to, you know, further build that relationship?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a very individual question. You know, it depends on the writer and what they're comfortable doing. You know, people will say in a vacuum, oh, you should blog, you should be on Twitter all the time, you should do this, you should do that. And I don't know if that's the right answer to the question. I think there's something to be said for mystery. I think there's something to be said for coming out with a book every 7 years and then vanishing in the meantime.
Right.
But, you know, there's also something to be said for writing a lot of essays and letters to newspapers and this and that. And it just depends on the writer and the forms that they like to use. I mean, I like to write essays, and I like to – I have these little pop cultural commentary type things that I want to get off my chest, and they're not going to fit in a framework of a book. And, you know, The Weaklings is a perfectly good platform to use for this stuff. Other people don't feel that way. You know, other people just want to write their books, and that's all they want to do. And good, you know, that's fine too. I don't think there's any one answer. If I had to guess and predict things, I think you're going to see less engagement going forward. I think you're going to see more writers, walk away from the social media and create more of an air of mystery, simply because that hasn't been done a lot, you know, certainly not lately. And the problem with that is that by walking away and creating an air of mystery, you're also not generating readers. So it's, you know, not everybody can do it. It'll be interesting to see if anybody can pull that off. But I think that that's something we're going to see soon. Somebody will be able to do it. They'll be able to write something and create a buzz about this mysterious person, and people will wonder about it, and the wondering will be better than them just having, you know, so-and-so, comma, author Facebook page.
Right. So last question. You know, as I mentioned earlier, your writing on The Weaklings covers such a breadth of topics, one of them being politics, and you wrote this wonderful piece about, you know, NSA and the prison program and why Americans don't put up more of a fight about having their rights and privacy so greatly violated. I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on those issues in these final moments.
Yeah. I think that there's these things are happening now that are absolutely going to impact. When I was in college, I really thought that we lived in a very boring time where nothing happened. And now I realize that the opposite is true, and this is a really pivotal point in human development. I mean, when you look at the climate change and the fact that once the temperature goes up another, I think, 2 degrees Celsius to 4, then everything's going to melt, and it's pretty much game over for the way things have been. And yet nobody cares. You know, anytime I write anything about the environment, no one reads it. People just don't want to hear about it. I wrote a piece that I pitched to Salon that was about how all the Republican candidates for president didn't even acknowledge that there was a problem, and how that was a big problem, that we should at least be acknowledging that it's a problem and then arguing about how to fix it. And they just turned it down, and they said, I've read this before, you know, but they haven't, because they don't publish it because nobody reads it. And I think with PRISM, it's the same thing. I mean, say what you want about Snowden. Maybe he's a sneaky kind of guy, but he certainly made a difficult choice to live the way he lived, to give us this information. And people, you know, just kind of yawn about it. It's baffling. I don't know that, you know, we're the stuff that Obama is doing, and I voted for him twice, and I think I like him. But the stuff that he's doing with, you know, not closing Gitmo and enhancing the Patriot Act and holding people without trial and the drone strikes and there's something else I'm forgetting. Now the surveillance, the mass surveillance, it's, you know, this is all totalitarian stuff. And, you know, Obama, I trust him not to be a dick, but, you know, if the next guy is somebody like Romney or worse, you know, who knows what would happen. I mean, the government can do an awful lot of things now, scary things. They don't do it, but just because they don't do it doesn't mean that they won't at some point. And I think it's really important to, you know, protect ourselves from these sort of laws that, to me are potentially terrifying. So the prism thing is that it's, you know, my piece was why, you know, every time, basically every time there's a privacy setting change in Facebook, people have a big fucking cow, but we find out that the government is spying on everybody all the time and nobody cares. It's just, I don't know if it's just so big and so hopeless that it's like throwing a, you know, it's like launching a slingshot at the Death Star or something, but it, you know, it's important and I have to keep, you know, plugging away at these things. It's like, now I don't know if you watch Newsroom, but that's the show on HBO that Aaron Sorkin wrote about these.
Right. And I know you're a big Adam Sorkin fan. I read that about you.
Yeah, I love him. But this show is a little hit or miss. But one of the plot points is about, you know, the government has launched this sarin gas attack in Afghanistan and killed some people. And the whole show is sort of predicated on if the government did that, that it would be a horrible thing and people would really give a crap. And, you know, people don't care. I mean, the Syrians just did it and nobody cares. You could certainly make an argument for that, you know, chemical weapons are just as viable and just as dangerous as drone strikes and everything else. But that's not what we're seeing right now. We're just seeing a collective yawn. Oh, they use chemical weapons. Eh, whatever. Look, Miley's twerking. Isn't that crazy? And
right.
You know, no one's used chemical weapons like this in a really long time. It's sort of a tacit rule of warfare that we don't do that. And now Syria has done it. So, you know, people are, last thing anybody wants is a protracted land war in Syria during the civil war. But to not do anything is also dangerous. Obama's in a real pickle with this, and
yes,
it'll be interesting to see how he what he decides to do.
Sobering happy note, with me today has been Greg Oliar, the founding editor of the Weeklings and the author of the LA Times best-selling book, novels Totally Killer and Father Mucker. Greg, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, what are the best ways for people to find out about you online?
Well, they can go to, I have a website, Greg Oliar, OLEAR.com, and then just go to the Weeklings. Just read the Weeklings, which is the Weeklings, WEEKLINGS.com. And pretty much everything I do is there. I'm the NSA knows where to find me, and so will anybody who types my name in Google, you know. So
nice.
There
nice.
I will be.
Yeah. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at WeVoiceSing.com, YouTube, Facebook. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. And after all that, big thanks to each and every one of you for listening in today. I'm Rich Ferguson, and this has been Poetescape.